Mark, you had a comment.
I think what you're hearing all morning is that, you know, there are 50 states. And like Glenn just said, there's Florida has a lot of herbs, there's a lot of laws, and so does Texas. Some don't have so many. And, you know, there's legislative sessions in every state every year. And a lot of times the way to get your name out there is to make some big, bold, anti-big snake law or anti-animal park law. And so there's rules that are updated constantly. And then there's lesser rules that the different state fish and game commissions can make unilaterally without having to go through processes or emergency rules. And I'm a retailer, Ken's a retailer, other people are retailers here that have over 600 different types of permits and licenses on the website. And I'm trying to make sure that I comply with all of them. And of course, there's federally, there's forest laws, and there's labeling laws. And there's this myriad of things. If you want to go to Puerto Rico, you're better off just exporting it to another country. If you want to go to Hawaii, it has to go to the Department of Ag. It's not so bad, but their residents have to get a permit first. Their agriculture department has to inspect it. Then it has to go to whichever island it's going to. Alaska doesn't have so many problems, but it's a long flavor. I don't think so well. It shouldn't go to Alaska. Range states, especially along the East Coast. A lot of people live in a lot of populated states with a lot more laws there. And so range states, any animals in range in there, have to be very careful. New York will let you have native species, any native species. And I grew up in New York the first 30 years of my life, but I could never have an eastern painted turtle there anymore. Customer calls me up and they want a painted turtle, it's going to have to be a western or a southern. Can't be a spiny soft shell because the range is into one of the Great Lakes that touches New York, so they could have a Florida, they can't have a spiny. Smooth they can have. And you got to know all these things. Oregon doesn't have a restricted list. They have a clean list, which is very small, and on turtles, but not tortoises. You have to know all those things, and the laws are constantly changing. I'll give you a great example. 2 weeks ago, I had a director from Wisconsin let me know that one species of turtle that we have was not allowed to possess in the state. And just fixed my website before it, you know, became a problem for me. That's the greatest heads up I can ever get, and I think all retailers can get. I wrote him back, thanked him, made it abundantly clear that that's the kind of input that I really need and appreciate. He came back with a couple other species, and I said, "Was there anything? You know, can you just go in and fix the website, and we make a note of it, and we don't take phone orders that way, and so on." I also invited him to this conference, and I think we already had an invite. State budgets are a little restricted, it's not what we need. But that kind of interaction is key. I'll give you another example, different story related. I got a call last week that I get a few times a year from my mosquito control department in my county, letting me know that there are spread mosquitoes. Now I have, I don't know, 300 bins of turtles ranging from half a gallon to a couple thousand gallons. And so we try to do a water change right after mosquito control comes by because they have no line. It's not a good thing. It's not particularly bad, but it's not good to have. And the turtle is drinking it in, especially with ears. So I get that alert. Just record it. Just to let you know, I'm plane flying in tonight if it's not going to be too many. Well, in my mind, I envision something like that where we all sign up to be on a list. And states can input, federal government can input, and all of us can just get those notifications. Hey, this affects you. Arizona just restricted whatever. If this affects you, Maine just restricted whatever. The federal government just restricted whatever. These types of things, it seems so feasible nowadays. I don't have the resources to put that together, but I think it is there. That's some sort of a hot list where I can get the notification, email. It doesn't have to be a phone call about the mosquito spray, but it could be an email about a new regulation because the laws are changing by the minute. Mike can tell you that. You know, they have to monitor the federal register all the time, and the state. And it's, you could have a team of people doing that with computers, and you still wouldn't be able to keep up. And the states that are working with it, and I hate to kiss Linda's butt, but I have to, because Florida spends over factories and has for decades to work with us. And we do all we can to reciprocate, and that just keeps it going. And other states see that, and they respond in kind. It's very, very useful. Without that kind of cooperation, it's almost impossible for any retailers to exist. And at the same time, constantly do the right thing. I'm getting all those kind of, why don't you want metallic back terrorists? Well, if you go to Maine to Texas, range states can't have people inland, you can send it off legally because they produced it legally. But you got to answer all these questions. And then you get all kinds of going on, like we talked about yesterday, somebody who wants to try to play a game. You know, I have a cousin who lives in Florida. We're trying to. A lot of the resources are spent getting people successful with their mentors, as it should be, educating them, teaching them, sharing insights, and troubleshooting their pictures with their setups. But a lot of resources are spent keeping up with the rules and playing the animal police. And due diligence in this day and age, to me, is as far as you have time for, you know, as much resources as you can go to. And it is very, very difficult. I wish there'd be some sort of a, I think there was talk about a national database for animals and species, but really just kind of a hotline, hot list, some sort of a site posting just, you know, any state you want to post, just restricted private ownership of the blank turtle, whichever range state. Probably the most range states now, but so I've got to keep note of that. I do have most of this in my head. What if I get hit in the head with that? I mean, for us to do it right takes a lot, and the states are willing. Most of the time, all the states are willing to sincerely help, but nobody pulls it all together. And I wish that this is a good forum for that, where we get ideas out there. Maybe somehow, some way, somebody can throw that together, because it'd be great to make our lives a lot easier and make it better for the animals, for all the agencies who are budgeted to do that. And I'd love to hear anybody's thoughts on that.
That's a damn good idea.
Yeah, Ken, quit pointing at me. I get volunteered for an awful lot of stuff. For those of you who don't know who I am and what I do for an actual living, besides put on reptile law symposiums, I'm Jeff Berenger. I run Kingsnake.com. Kingsnake.com, since its inception in 1997, basically turned into kind of a cross between Facebook and Craigslist for the reptile world. And I can tell you my own personal experiences. I'm known throughout the industry as the most subpoenaed man in the reptile industry. And that's no joke. Up until a couple of years ago, I was averaging getting 30 law enforcement requests a year for data on people selling animals on my site. We get complaints all the time. This is illegal to sell. How can you let people sell it on your site? The plain and simple answer is, everything on my site that's alive is illegal somewhere. And everything on my site that's live is legal somewhere. And it's impossible for Kingsnake.com to act as a law enforcement agency, as an attorney, or as a conservation organization in that format, because there are so many different laws in so many different places, interpreted so many different ways by so many different agencies. So, what are we going to do? We got 50 states. We got the federal government with a half dozen agencies that are involved in all this. The answer is a national database. And one of the presentations that I was going to put on here, but we really didn't have the time to do it this weekend, was to put together a national database of reptile and amphibian laws that was updated. And that's something that I'm going to pursue with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They actually have done something similar to this in-house, but they've got the same problems we do. There's 50 states. Not all 50 states want to cooperate, especially with the federal government. So putting something together like a database is needed, and it's something that I'm going to be working with, trying to get together with U.S. Fish and Wildlife to put something in place. Obviously, the Lacey Act is a good incentive to do that, because the Lacey Act restricts interstate transport of species. But I'm going to need your help when we get there, because I'm going to need some input from everybody in the various states. What do they need? What are they lacking? And I'm going to need some help pushing the government to do this, because sometimes the government doesn't like to do things that are in its best interest. Yeah. You will, but you would be surprised at how many people would whine. But that's really beside the point. One of the reasons I brought this event here, one of the reasons I put this event together, was to start putting some groundwork together so that we can start working on state laws and federal laws and at the very least, get an inventory of them all. Much to my surprise, I found out that the feds had done that. They've got a nice book that somebody has given me to loan it to me. And hopefully I'm going to get with the people that put that book together to see what we can do to get this online someplace. And hopefully, if we can't get it on the Fish and Wildlife site, we'll put it on the NRAC site. The NRAC site actually has a prototype of this in place that already has the state laws for all 50 states up there. So you can take a look at some of the work that we've already done. It's out of date. Quite simply, we need to hire somebody to run that. That's what the book we're talking about. Yeah.
But it's gonna be out of date.
It's out of date the minute it's
every legislative session you're gonna see new bills introduced. And even outside legislative session you'll see rulemakings going on.
We have slaps every week. There's no legislation required.
And it's not even as simple a matter as keeping list the species either, because as we've just seen from just talking about four states here, states don't always do things the same way. We were sitting down with the agency in Connecticut, and they gave us a list this big of species that they're talking about listing and saying, let us know what you don't think should be on this list. And I said, well, what are you listing them for? Exotic, native, non-native, federally regulated. They said all of the above or anything else. So there isn't necessarily even a reason why they're going to list it. They're just saying, well, we think this ought to be on the list. So there's no uniform standard by which states are regulating these things. So it's a challenging. Which makes trying to do something online the sensible approach. But even with that, you're going to have the caveat that this thing is not going to be 100% up to date because it's changing that rapidly.
But if every state agency that comes up with a new post the reg, in plain text reading what it really means.
Except they don't even know what it really means sometimes.
Right. I mean, if you take a look at the State of the Union book, there are a number of states that didn't submit. So right off the bat, we've got an example of one of the big issues putting something like this together. But in the long run, for everybody's sake, it's going to be best to do this, and it's something that we need to do now, and especially now that we've got this wonderful thing called DNA analysis that allows us to come up with new species left and right, it appears. Because we're going to see more regulations and more species added to these regulations. If you take, say, a blind salamander, I'll use the Texas blind salamander because Andy loves it when I talk about his salamanders. If you take the Texas blind salamanders, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, there was one Texas blind salamander. Now how many do we have, Andy?
One.
But we have in terms of
for Central Texas, you're in 2000. We had several described.
Right.
They didn't separate different. We have one more. So we had four described the last decade. But that's the way it goes. We have new techniques available.
Yep.
And you have researchers revisiting groups that have been looked at 30 years. And it's no surprise that we are going to, in some cases, we're going to recognize diversity that was previously looked at. Others, or sink things left and right. So we still have one species moved things up for you.
So basically, while we may be losing a few species, we're gaining more species than we're losing just through the technology and the science. And as we gain more species, we're going to gain more laws and regulations. And you know, this whole conference was about putting a ground, putting a starting point together for us to work with these agencies and organizations to start putting together something like a major online database so that we all have access to that information, and so that it's just not the State Game Wardens Association that has that book. I like to think that I'm pretty well versed in reptile and amphibian law, and a lot of people here like to think that I'm well versed in reptile and amphibian law. I had no idea that that book even existed until Andy brought it to my attention, and that was just a month or so ago.
I don't know why they haven't publicized that more. It's not was intended to be a secret. You know, the whole idea is that you get that. So where do you find it?
My colleague.
It's on the internet.
It's on the internet. It's on the internet. It's on their website. Yeah. It just came out. It's not like it's been out.
But I think I got it. Utilization pretty much anybody who needs to can go on and sign up for email alerts.
I would envision a database system of that nature. The problem that you've got is, once again, that state regulations are all very varied and different, and there's no one cookie-cutter way to make a database that makes it all-inclusive, because Minnesota has virtually no laws, and how do you database that?
Well, not only that, you can have the same terminology used in different states meaning different things.
And then you've got some states that recognize to a species level, and some states that recognize to a subspecies level.
Every state has this place on there, and then there's contact phone numbers or emails. I think that would be a good first step.
Well, that's already on the website, on our NRAC website, as part of our law database that we created. So you can go and find all the state agencies on the NRAC website with all the contacts there, with phone numbers and links to websites, links to actual laws and regulations that they've published online. But, you know, state laws, states have state rights. They don't like to be forced into doing anything by a bigger entity like the federal government, and they don't like to be forced into... They like to do things in their own way, in their own format. And I don't think that'll ever change. So it's going to be difficult, but it's something that we need to do. It's something that needs to be done. And so...
Well, and which the pitch you need to be making to the states is, we're trying to enhance compliance with your laws and regulations.
Right.
And we're just asking you to help facilitate that.
Right.
I have a question for Linda. In Florida, with your venomous reptile regulations and law, does state law in Florida... Does that trump local city ordinances?
Good question.
What I see happening here and in other places is you get a permit from the state to keep X, Y, and Z, and then you end up with city hold on for some other place. You know, we got an ordinance. You can't keep that. That's your limits. So you get a state permit to keep it. Then every time you move from one bird to another, you have to readjust and what have you. In Texas, in most cases, not necessarily reptile related, but generally state law in Texas generally trumps city ordinances. But in this case. Your permit specifically required to comply with city ordinances, which...
Does that apply to zoning law as well?
Yeah, our permit is an exemption from any other city, state, or local law.
No. Yeah, and just the other way around, in general, unless a specific state law says right within it that it is superseding all local ordinances or laws in contrary. In Minnesota, that's the way the gun law is written. Generally, you can be more restrictive on a local level, but you can't be less restrictive. So, so if the state law is X, a local city or county ordinance can be more restrictive, but not less so.
Unless the state law explicitly preempts it.
State law prohibits.
But the point I was making is you also have local regulation for different purposes. You might have local regulation of animals that are deemed dangerous or whatever their basis for regulating them. You'll also have separate zoning requirements that have nothing to do with the state permit for possessing something.
It might be designed as a zoning ordinance regarding the keeping of roosters in a community based on a noise or public health basis,
and
having nothing to do with that,
and that's going to vary from every local jurisdiction to the next.
Where that leads, hopefully, is the purpose of the community is you're trying to satisfy 2, 3, 4 masters, and it gets complicated. I remember there was some issues in Florida where dogs down there several years ago. I don't remember the exact date, but there was some.
Right, and a lot of that had to do with personal possession of wildlife. The answer to your question, yes and no. Qualify that, because the commission has a constitutional authority to regulate wildlife. On the local level, again, they can regulate as far as not specifically targeting wildlife per se, but requirements in general.
Choice.
So if you have to have a cage, you can have a cougar that's 10 foot high. If they prohibit, you can't have any fences 10 foot high within county limits, as far as part of the zoning ordinance, then that would preclude you from meeting the state requirements and not being able to possess the animal on the house. So it's, we have faced some of those challenges. That is something that is going to continue to come up at the local level, particularly with potentially dangerous wildlife, with crocodilian species, some of your monitors, tegus, your venomous reptiles. We'll see. I'm sure you're probably already seeing a lot of that.
But cities are passing ordinances that prohibit specific species from being killed.
They do. That does occur. Is the agency going to call the city or county to task on that? No. It's probably going to take in reality, the industry possessors to call the county to task. But yes, that does occur.
So when they call to task, they would have to use y'all's law. It's been what's contrary to what the city requires.
Well, but it's not really contrary, though. They're enforcing the state law, have the ability to enforce the state law, but the municipality has the ability to accept that as a minimum standard and expand on
it. Unless you have something in your law that specifically says.
Right.
Well, there's cities here that will exempt you, like if the ordinance says you can't have whatever, they'll have somewhere in there. You're exempt from that if you have a state
permit. I've seen a couple of those. That's livable.
Yeah.
But so many of the city ordinances are protected anyway. So
you can't have any dogs and cats in
here. Some of them. I've written and found one that you can't have a three truck and a fish.
Yeah.
But some of the ordinances in Texas, a lot of them, you start looking at them and they're sort of cookie cutter designed from animal rights organizations that have flooded the various cities with. These are things you should do. And basically, you've got a dog, or more than one dog, or one cat, or more than three tropical fish. You know, you can't have.
Right. That is true. You see a lot of, especially when they have campaigns and they're going to one locality to the next and just pushing this model. Do we have questions from the audience as well?
I don't think so. I mean, the North Haven. Right, they're on the whitelist. Anything on the whitelist, you can collect as many as you want. None of that stuff has restrictions, bag limits. Well, without a permit, there's bag limits. There's any. I haven't heard anything about that, but maybe Western Diamondback and the UCC, those are reflections for.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. Any sort of change like that just needs to be backed by So there's good reason to think about a Western Diamondback in this game species because essentially it's treated as a game species. The where that differs is that the vast majority of Western Diamondbacks are collected in Texas or collected for the park system. And that conflicts with the way we treat game in Texas. You're not allowed to collect deer for parks. You're not allowed to sell wild caught venison. So there's an issue there. So, but an argument can be made that they're treated that way. And then, as you said, there's a whole change of perspective that comes from a species label like that in terms of giving more protection to certain. And frankly, whether you like the rattlesnake trade or not, it's big. And there's a lot of money that changes hands. And there's reason for, aside from conservation issues, which is my bread and butter, there's reason that Texas and Texas Parks and Wildlife should be interested in monitoring and influencing that trade.
Other questions or comments?
Somebody has a scientific research permit that y'all are all out there collecting under, and the permittee is with you. No,
so
the person who takes it from the wild.
If you're taking a class with Jim Dixon and you're on the field trip with Jim Dixon, you're covered under Jim Dixon.
Under him.
But if you go out for extra credit
without
getting
that,
other questions? Yes, sir.
I think just a comment. I think it's vital that everybody knows inside and out their local laws pertaining to keeping reptiles in the community capacity. Not only to keep you from the wrong side of the law, but also to defend yourself from those who wield these laws according to their own opinions and such. We all see that. A lot of times these laws are interpreted by different people. Issuing these permits in their own way. So know your laws, know what they say, know what they mean, and usually how we get on the
tailor. I just want to, and that sounds great in theory, that is, we are regulated by city, by county, state, and by federal law, you almost have to be an attorney to keep up with the amount of law. The own agencies half the time can't keep up with their own laws. That's putting a common Joe citizen taxpayer at a major disadvantage to know every bit of those laws and as fast as they're changing. There's got to be a better way to get it.
Yeah. where the places were taken are towns where the state has this. There's a number of people that have no clue this kind of thing.
Pick a law, pick an area, and the number of people who have no clue. I mean, you know, how many times do you see people passing a school bus? It's red lights go.
Do you really?
Yeah. And it's outrageous. Go back to my being 9 years old and heading back to Indiana with a bucket full of horned toads. I mean, a 9 year old certainly can't be expected to know the law. His parents shouldn't don't have that luxury because failing to know the law is no excuse for breaking the law. They'll still arrest you. They'll still ticket you. They'll still fine you. But yeah, it's education the general public. Is probably going to be our most difficult task, simply because there's so many of them, and there's so many, especially now, there's so many channels of information coming in. People are hitting information overload. So you know, it's nobody's going to track me down. It's a little law. Nobody checks Craigslist. Well, I can tell you.
But thank you.
And Craigslist doesn't allow you to sell.
First of all, it's just really, really, really ugly. Two Texas tortoises out there. Craigslist, $200. Looks great for them.
Mark?
I think the good news is I was into this as a kid, and then I got back into it after school in the early 90s, and I had a lot of friends in it, and my impression was this whole mentality from probably the 70s, certainly in the 80s, was that it was a very adversarial relationship between regulatory agencies, states, and federal government, and people who were interested in more people in the actual industry itself. And there was this transformation that seemed to take place during the 90s where working together was almost completely unheard of. And it was really like, you know, the dark side, the bad guys, and us. And they probably viewed us that way too back in the 80s. I don't know, I wasn't in it. And really, by the time we got into the whole problem of ticks in 1999, 2000, I know there was some. Just turnover. There was just people who were retiring in our state agencies. And then there was the next generation of people who were coming up through the ranks, and the mentality was completely different. And we all were kind of like mistrusting of it. Well, that can't possibly be, especially people who are not longer than me. And now it's just, now you go a couple of decades, and it's hard to say that's not the case. And on state level, too, I've had long conversations with the point person. Does all this for Massachusetts, New Mexico, Oregon. People take time out to call and go over the radio and just email and have long conversations, but they really believe that the right answer is not running around being animal police and slamming doors. They believe it's with interaction and education, cooperation, and everybody's supposed to be keeping an eye on the real, few crooks that are out there. And I think that is really, really good news. You almost never hear about this nasty state anymore. Even the feds who are here the last couple of days, I didn't listen to these people talk about. It's really positive, it's really cooperative, it's wanting to help, wanting to accomplish the same goals through cooperation. I think that's really, really important. I think even, with the CDC and the FDA and USDA, I know in our state, the USDA and the Florida Department of Ag is almost at every meeting, everything. We're all on the same table all the time. You know everybody after a while. And your friends, you know about their family. They get that personal because they really have the same goals. They're not here to shut it down. At this point, it's only some of the animal rights groups that are really on the dark side. Everybody else is trying to conservation. And I think it's a real positive thing because 20 years ago when I started, it was nothing like that. It was really, it was us and them. And now it's all us.
It's all we.
Here's the dark flip side of that. 20 years ago, there was not nearly the amount of regulations that we have today.
Sure.
Okay. So is what we are doing in the last 20 years, is it really working for a broad spectrum of everybody involved? Or is it
addressing more of the needs? I mean, there's also a lot more of this exponential growth of herpers since then, too.
Yeah.
And a number of different species coming in, too.
And a lot more accessibility with the internet, there's so much more distribution ability. So I think that I've yet to see a law at large. I just put a lot of laws on the sidewalk. I didn't get to see a law that really wasn't warranted to fall for. There's a lot of politics that goes on and that's misshapen, but there are needs there. And they have to address it. And I'm sitting listening to negative stuff and I'm thinking, oh, God, I've got to do more. But the reality is everything that they have is because the situation came up several times, and they had to deal with this division, that division, these different animals, in every state of the situation. They're all imported species, like the various types of situations. So you have to address everything. You can't just depend on them. Is there overregulation? You know, there's always going to be some people in state agencies in all walks of life who want to further their own agenda. That's why people call me and they say, can I have that in my state? As far as I know, yes, but what I encourage you to do is contact the state. And before you do that, what I encourage you to do is go on their website and see what it says in print. See if you can find statutes. I think they're probably the person. But you never know if the receptionist may just be anti-M or anti-something. But if you can confirm, and they get to a person who talks to intelligently, regardless of their personal opinions, pretty much what you can ask for it. For the most part, I never hear anything about rogue states or people who are really hard to deal with.
Jack? 30 years ago, reptile owners were hobbyists. There was no reptile industry. There was no reptile breeding for the most part. 20 years ago, that changed when hobbyists started breeding, and we saw the birth of an industry. 15 years ago, the internet showed up, and that really was like adding fertilizer to our industry because we saw many, 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 many more people come in, not only as hobbyists, but as businesses. And we saw an actual industry form. 15 years ago, when Kingsnake.com started, the industry had a good enough footing that by the time state agencies found Kingsnake.com, they were shocked to find out just how many of the animals from their states were entering the marketplace. Texas is a good example. A lot of the regulations in Texas laws and Texas codes actually came because of Kingsnake.com, because they saw the breadth and depth of the industry and they were concerned that all these animals were going out. They weren't collecting any data on what was going out, what was produced. They didn't even know that we were captive producing these animals.
So basically you're taking credit for people being overregulated?
In Texas, I am, actually. In Texas, I am. I'm going to work to change that. But that's just an example of what we're seeing. The more people that we've seen a 100-fold increase in the last 20 years in the number of people that are not only hobbyists but businesses in this. And with that, with any industry, you're going to be regulated. And as we grow as an industry, we're going to be more regulated. And we need to be prepared and willing to deal with the regulators as an industry. And that doesn't... that. We've been fighting laws for 20 years. We need to start talking about laws and not fighting them. We need to talk to them. We need to open lines of communication. And we need to build bridges and show them where there are issues and errors with their laws and help them correct it. Talking is a lot better than fighting. And I think that's one of the reasons I put this together, was to open some of those lines of communication and start that talking. And I think 10 years from now, we're going to see a wide change if we do that. We're going to see a change in the agencies we deal with, and they're going to deal with this more on a personal level, more on an industry level, and treat us more like the friends that we need to be. Because we need to be friends. I need to be able to go down to Texas Parks and Wildlife and say, hey, look, we've got a problem with the species versus subspecies clause in your laws. We need to see if we can find a workaround. I don't need to go up to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission and say, we need to stop these laws because they're not good. No, we don't need to stop the laws. We need to make good laws because we need to be regulated to some extent, because they need to know what we're doing isn't damaging the populations of these animals in the wild. Or they need to know if they are. You know, the turtle problem that we've had with the Asian turtles really brought a lot of this to the forefront. When you know, the airport in Dallas calls up and says, I've got a guy wanting to ship 10 tons of turtles to China. What regulations are there? And there are no regulations. Well, there need to be some regulations. We need to take a look at what's going on, and we need to regulate, but we need to regulate fairly, and we need to work with these agencies, and the agencies need to work with us. And to do that, you know, both of us need to eat a little crow and accept that, you know, maybe being a fighter for the last 20 years wasn't the right way to do it. So, yes.
One of the things that I observed before, where things are probably acute in a lot of places, is that by historical reasons, fishing game agencies build fishing game. A lot of resources go to that. Certainly non-game has become far more important in the last 15, 20 years. But the amount of resources they're able to put toward that is, most of my experience, minuscule compared to the other things. And the result is they don't have the staff to get the kind of data that we'd all really like to make the decisions that affect the resource and the resource users. So I would say that would be something that ought to be part of the conversation with the natural resource agencies. There's nothing better than a long-term reliable data set. Florida, we were fortunate enough to be able to allocate that to do with non-native fishes. We had a 30-year record of data, which is unfortunately absent for a lot of the other taxa. That enabled us to make some decisions and, in fact, dispel some of the earlier notions that we had about what's really going on out there. And I know that there are people in Florida when they got hit with the turtle thing. There's just no way that they could run out and gather the records of data to really, really try to bring in the confidence that you had. Say you, by nature, as a resource agency, aren't going to be protected with resources. I would really say that ought to be a part of the future conversation.
Yeah, absolutely agree. PJAC sees thousands of bills every year introduced regulating the pet industry in some way. And I'm not going to tell you that a lot of those aren't bad bills. But as Mark and Jeff are pointing out, they're frequently motivated by some necessity. There's some purpose behind their introduction. And a lot of times the sponsor is ignorant about you know, the issue in large part. He might be drafting it based on somebody that comes to him and says, we need this. But it's our job to inform them, and it's our job to provide them the data and the information they need to make sure that we're going to see good laws instead of bad laws. The fact of the matter is, regulation is going to exist, and you can either be part of that process and try to make sure we're accomplishing something that's going to regulate effectively without being overburdensome, or you can be on the outside and have them impose it on you.
Regulators have an easy time regulating things like cars, because most people have a car, most people have a driver's license, so you go to the legislature, almost everybody in that legislature that's a senator or a congressman, he's got a driver's license, he's got a car, so he understands the needs and the problems of having a car and owning a car. They don't have turtles and they don't have snakes in general. So these people, they're regulating things that they're not familiar with, and when you do that, you make a lot of mistakes. And so what we need to do is put ourselves in a position where we can be their go-to guys to get them the information that they don't have so they can make good laws.
And you're going to get to be their go-to guys if you establish credibility, which means, number one, that you're in compliance with laws, and number two, that you're going to recognize that there's need for some regulation. And you know, then they're going to rely on you because you've established credibility. Other comments or questions?
First. So, because like what was going on is I had a situation with a rehabber who took a deer on to a veterinarian. The veterinarian didn't have a rehab permit, it was her veterinarian that she used, but he's like not on her permit. He took this deer fawn from her, it had broke legs repeatedly, so he took it from her and we didn't give it back. And called law enforcement and they're like, well, typically with veterinarian, the welfare of the animal comes first. Because most things that an animal goes to vet for with wildlife can't be solved in 48 hours. A lot of times veterinarian needs to house that animal, take care of something. So there's nothing that says a veterinarian can't treat wildlife. But when it's something that they have illegally, like it's something they're keeping as a pet. It's one thing if somebody brings you a baby squirrel they found on the ground or and injured something that they just found, that's one thing. And that needs to stay with you and go to a rehabber, or go to a rehabber if it needs to, if it's not life-threatening. But when they have something they've had for a while, illegally, a possum, raccoon, skunk, Texas tortoise, pet.
They're bringing you baby Texas tortoises.
That is something, you know, if it's something that needs immediate attention, yes, treat it. But they need to be made aware, if you have this illegally, if, depending on their attitude towards you, you may or may not decide to call a game warden. What I tell people is when they call me going, oh, I've had this for a while, or a veterinarian call me and say, hey, somebody, one of my clients has a pet possum they've had for years, I try to encourage them to let that person know that they're in illegal possession. They need to take it to a rehabber. Even if it's something they've had for years and it's perfectly healthy, the avenue of getting it to an educational person or a zoo or somewhere where it needs to go permanently, especially if it's fairly imprinted, is it has to go to a rehabber first. Rehabber has to establish whether it's releasable or not. So I encourage them when I am called by either a veterinarian or they're saying, my friend has this, you need to contact a rehabber. I have had one individual who I told he had a raccoon, is what it was. He had it for a while. And his friend went to Minnesota or somewhere and came back with an albino raccoon. So she's not only breaking our rules, breaking health department rules. So with raccoons, you're not, you're filing two state agency laws. But he was very aggressive with me and was saying, well, if somebody shows up, I'm not giving it back. Basically, threatened to have guns and all this great stuff. And I was like, okay, write down your phone number, write down the name you told me, send it to law enforcement. I most of the time just say, hey, here's a rehabber, call a rehabber, and then I forget it. Because that's all you can do. You're either going to take it to a rehabber, and you're going to keep housing the animal, and hopefully we're taking care of it. They're going to maybe take it to a veterinarian. I mean, either eventually you get caught with it and walking down the street in town, and then on their shoulder, there's something weird. Because there are just tons of people out there that have these things that nobody ever knows about. And the animal lives a healthy, long life, and nobody ever knows about it.
You get these phone calls too, but I often get phone calls when grandma dies,
yes.
Or when they're putting dad in a home, and he had 80 box turtles, or grandma had Texas tortoises for the last 30 years, and there's 18 generations of Texas tortoises in the yard. That's the kind of thing that I really want to try to avoid. If somebody has a tortoise that was a family pet since God was a boy or whatever, that's not such a big deal. The irresponsible backyard breeding, they create this huge problem because I'm not currently allowing people to release Texas tortoises under most circumstances. If I get a Texas tortoise, it goes to actually my favorite place to send them is Jill Heatley at Texas A&M. Because she's establishing a colony and she's researching some of these diseases and stuff in them. But, it's a sad story when there are dozens and dozens of these animals. On that note, some of you may have seen at the table out front, I had some brochures about Texas tortoise. I've got them in Spanish and English. I've got some more in my bag. They're intended for, y'all know enough about Texas tortoises, I'm sure, but the intention behind those is get them in the hands of people before they pick one of these things up. After they pick it up and they go on the internet and they're learning about it, it's too late. So the idea is to, get these brochures in people's hands before they pick up Texas tortoises. I've also got all that information online, but if you want one, I've got something to add with it.
Okay, we got time for another couple questions real quick.
I don't really have any guests in Texas tortoises. I usually like to call if people found out it's illegal and they can turn it over. I will say, I will take it, and then someone will turn you in. So I don't even report where it came from. I'm
going to
drop off on the
paperwork
so that if people are comfortable,
they
don't get trouble, and I'll still stand for
it. You're
turning it over.
Did you get that on the
Yeah. Right here, buddy. Right here.
Yes, sir.
Do we establish that there is or isn't any liability for the veterinarians?
They can't control what people bring to them. And if it's in the best interest of the animal if the veterinarian do something, I mean, I'm not going to say that somebody brings you a raccoon with this gash on its neck that you can't suture it up, but there should be some responsibility of the veterinarian to go, hey, illegal for you to have this, you need to find a rehabber.
That's really... She's not an attorney.
Right.
She's not in the legal department. And you guys are asking her a very, very specific question about legal liability.
And the answer to that question is dependent on state law. It's not the same from one state to another. There are frequently statutes that actually dictate the affirmative duty of people in that position, professional veterinarians in that position. So it's dependent on state law, and I can't answer that question for this state, but like Jeff says, it's a legal question. She's telling you what she'll do in practice, but she's not speaking to the law, correct?
So, in that tone and tenor, the right way to get an answer for your question specifically would be to contact the legal department the legal division at Texas Parks and Wildlife and ask them for an opinion. Because if they give you an opinion, it will come from the legal division, from a lawyer, and you can take that to court.
As a Texas lawyer, and I represent the Texas municipalities on the side, I think Parks and Wildlife would want the answer on that question, and similar to the TVMA, every state has a state veterinary medical association. They have legal counsel because they advocate the law for certain bills, and that would be the avenue to pursue a personal legal liability question, especially with the license.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Do we have any last question before we adjourn for lunch? Okay, thank you everybody. Oh, wait.
I think it's important to note, too, that when these people come in with these animals, you don't want to be able to frighten them with the law. I think you want them to do is run out and throw this animal backwards and along and try to get you to drive them around.
Right.
With Michael Fletcher, my voice is out of the wild. You want to work with them and engage the dish will always go to death, but not keep them knocking on their door and black helicopters and all that stuff. And the animal needs to be, there is the process of these animals. Whether it's illegal or not, they're not out of the process of getting the animals if they have a tortoise. The last thing you want to send a tortoise to go back out and spray.
As a practical matter, we'd like to see everybody involved facilitate the proper disposition.
All right, well, yeah.
Right, but with other animals, there's nothing in our rules that requires them to test any of the animals for anything before they release them. They can turn loose. Now, it does state they can only release things that because they could fend for themselves or be, you know, completely nothing what it says. But, so, like, they can't turn loose three-legged stuff. They can't turn stuff loose that's missing an eye unless they documented it and found this animal is successful with one eye, you know. When they do want to keep things as non-releasable, however, they have to take the animal to a veterinarian. The veterinarian has to, on their letterhead, write, this animal is non-releasable and why. A lot of the rehabbers, some of them, the good ones, they are qualified to go, yes, this animal... has vision problems or is preventing them from hunting successfully. But the way the regs are written, we have to have something to document. Well, it says that as determined by the department to be non-leasable. That's what it says. Well, the only way I can do that is I have a written statement from a veterinarian certifying, yes, this animal has been evaluated, because rehabbers aren't veterinarians. Most of the rehabbers aren't qualified to be veterinarians. And so while they can have monitored this animal for 6 months and knows this raptor is not successfully hunting game because of vision problems or whatever, they're still not, in my opinion, not fully qualified to make that decision. The veterinarian is a bird raptor specialist veterinarian can, but and even some of the, there are rehabbers who can are qualified because they've been doing it for 20 years. But to be fair to everybody, to all the rehabbers, and to be consistent, we require veterinary letters from all of them stating, yes, this animal is not visible. But then you look at the other way, well, then you have all these rehabbers that are saying, oh yeah, this animal's releasable, let's check it back out. But they are, in a way, held accountable for releasing animals that can successfully.
You know, push your heart in 3 months to